I'm Jeff Sickinga, Executive Director of the Ashbrook Center, and this is The American Idea, where we discuss the ideas, people, and events that have made America what it is today. We believe that by understanding our history and our principles, we can better live up to the promise of the American founding and preserve our ongoing experiment in self-government. Welcome to The American Idea.
Hello and welcome everyone to this episode of The American Idea. Today we're going to be talking about a fascinating topic, one that is sort of always in the news. We just never know when it's going to be in the news. And that is the question of unexpected crises, disasters, and the president's response to them. And I am joined for that conversation today by Tevi Troy. There's probably no one in the country who is a more learned and well-written and well-thought-out expert on this very important topic than Tevi. He is the Senior Fellow at the Bipartisan Policy Center, also Senior Fellow at the Strauss Center at Yeshiva University, where he teaches. He has been Deputy Assistant to the President for Domestic Policy and also Deputy Secretary of the Department of Health and Human Services. So we have someone who has been in the executive branch at the highest levels, counselor to presidents on significant, important issues facing the country. He received his bachelor's degree from Cornell University and his PhD from the University of Texas at Austin. Also a terrific author. We're going to be talking about one of his books, but he's got a lot of great books, Intellectuals and the American Presidency, Fight House, which sounds like a great book, Rivalries in the White House from Truman to Trump, and the latest project, which I think is called The Power and the Money. It's going to be a conversation, a book about presidents and CEOs. Tevi, just give us a little preview of this interesting project.
Yeah, well, first of all, thanks for having me, Jeff, and thanks to the Ashbrook Center. And I was a big fan of the late Peter Schramm, so I'm glad to participate in any way with you guys. The book, The Power and the Money, which hopefully is coming in August, is a book about big name CEOs. Think Rockefeller, Ford, Gates, Musk, Zuckerberg, and their clashes with presidents. And the really interesting thing about this book, Jeff, is that each of these CEOs had tenures longer than a president. So they got to deal with multiple presidents, and this book allows you to compare and contrast how they dealt with the different presidents. Some they dealt with better than others, and they tried different models, they tried different approaches, and some were successful and some weren't. And it's really a great story about the rise of American industry and the growth of American government at the same time, to the point where today they're almost intertwined, and you cannot be a successful CEO unless you have a strategy for dealing with the government. That was not the case when John D. Rockefeller built his monopoly in the 1870s, he could have done anything he wanted without government intervention because it wasn't relevant to him. But now every CEO has to be thinking about what the government's going to do, and befriending a president or sometimes taking on a president is necessary to your business model.
Fascinating book, really interesting topic. Let's recommend it again, The Power and the Money by Tevi Troy when it comes out. Make sure you get your copy. It's going to be a great read, as are all his books, including the one we want to talk about.
It's already up on Amazon.
Let's do that. And including the one, of course, we want to talk about today, Shall We Wake the President? Two Centuries of Disaster Management from the Oval Office. One of the things that I was struck by in your book was a quote from President Obama. And in that quote, he says, "Who thought we were going to have to deal with pirates?"
I love that quote.
It turns out, though, unexpected crises, as you outline in your wonderful book, have been around since the founding of the Republic. As long as there have been presidents, there have been unexpected crises that have had to be managed. Talk a little bit about the early Republic. Let's start there, if we can. Crises that faced our first presidents.
Well, first, let me just say something about President Obama. As you can imagine, I'm not the biggest fan of him, but he was faced with a whole bunch of crises when he comes into office, and they were unexpected, right? He didn't think he'd have to deal with Somali pirates, and obviously the American economy was in terrible shape, and the swine flu came in early 2009. It didn't turn out to be as bad as people feared, but it was still worrisome. And we saw recently that a bad disease can really cripple an entire economy. And then he had to deal with the BP oil spill. So he goes into office, he's got all these big plans, and suddenly he realizes that he's just a crisis manager. And so I have some sympathy for him, even if I wasn't a big fan of his policies. So let's go back to the early republic, which was the basis of your question. And if you think about it, our earliest presidents, Washington, Jefferson, Adams, they wouldn't know about some of these things. I mean, first of all, there was no chance that there would be an oil spill in the Gulf that was caused by human drilling because we didn't have the capacity to do it. But he wouldn't know about it because there was no instantaneous communication. And some of these other things like Somali pirates, I mean, how long would it take to find out that pirates had taken American ships? And indeed, Jefferson did have to deal with the Barbary pirates, but he was dealing with it on a months down the road basis instead of on an immediate basis, where if you see the movie about that Captain Phillips, I mean, the government policymakers had real-time satellite footage of what was going on. So it's just such a different animal. And what I talk about in the book is that in the early days of our great republic, both constitutionally and logistically, there was no expectation that government would get involved in disasters. And indeed, I mentioned that President Madison was president while there was a massive earthquake in Missouri. The information about the earthquake took 6 weeks to reach Washington. And so what's Madison going to do at that point? Send a wagon train out with supplies that'll take another 6 weeks to get there? I mean, the people on the ground handled it as best they could, and they moved on. And as the course of American history changed and the size of the government grew and the expectations of the American people grew, then there was suddenly the sense that the president did have to get involved in all of these various crises or disasters that take place on the local level. I'm not necessarily sure it's good for our constitutional republic. I'm not necessarily sure it's good for democracy, but it is the expectation that the American people now have.
So just give us a sense, if you would, of when then, if in the early republic, presidents don't know about disasters that happen right away, for example, a natural disaster, and can't respond quickly because of the technological situation and communications and roads and railroads, when do we have the first moment in American history where there is a crisis unexpectedly, and either the public demands that the president act or the president themselves think, I have to act?
Yeah, well, let's start with the 1927 Mississippi floods, where you've got President Coolidge in office, and I think he's great, and he's a small government conservative, and I applaud him for that. But suddenly, when these floods take place, you have a situation where you've got radio linking the nation together, and you have a popular press, and you have not just trains, but automobiles. And so people know about things a lot faster then. And there's outside public pressure, including comedians like Will Rogers, who are making fun of Coolidge for not doing anything. And he's saying that Coolidge is waiting to act because he thinks if he waits long enough, all the people will be dead, thereby removing the necessity of having to act. It's not the funniest joke in the world,
right?
But it is kind of a precursor to the jokes you'll hear on the late night talk shows when Bush was a little slow on Hurricane Andrew, or his son George W. Bush was slow on Hurricane Katrina. So this kind of sentiment that the American people want to help. We're a very generous and kind-spirited people, and we want to help when there is trouble. And so we often look to the president to do that. But so in 1927, Coolidge is under all this pressure. And he has a Secretary of Commerce named Herbert Hoover. Now, Hoover was a very competent mining engineer. He helped get food to the starving people of Europe in World War I. And when he sees a problem, he wants to fix it. That's what he's good at. So he starts nagging Coolidge to get involved. Coolidge is disinclined, but the outside pressure from the Rogers jokes and also the kind of natural inclination of Hoover lead Coolidge to send him to go to the Gulf area to deal with the people who are affected by this Mississippi flood. And it's really the first disaster czar in American history. You've got Hoover goes down there. He actually does a very good job by all accounts, even though Coolidge may have sent him to some degree to just get him off his case. But Hoover does a good job. He organizes the various entities that are trying to solve the problem or help with the problem. And he actually rides the popularity from that and the other things he's done throughout his career to become president after the 1928 election. So it was a kind of a successful government intervention, but it wasn't really the expectation before that period. And then let me just quickly finish up on that, which is 1932, Hoover did not do a very good job with the Great Depression, which is ironic because he was seen as a master of emergencies, a master of disasters. And then Roosevelt, Franklin D. Roosevelt comes in, and Roosevelt gets the government much more involved both domestically and internationally. And then that it leads to that increased expectation that the government will get involved when something bad happens.
Yeah, and people, I think a lot of our listeners who know some of the history, early 20th century and on, would say, when do agencies like FEMA come in? Because that seems like one agency through which presidents exercise in response to immediate and unexpected disasters and crises. Is that part and parcel of the New Deal? Does it come much later? Where does that enter the conversation?
FEMA comes to be in the Carter administration. And FEMA, I would say, gets a little more politicized under Clinton. Not politicized in the way we think about it today, but Clinton recognized there was political value to being seen on top of these disasters. And he also saw that President Bush, whom he defeated in the 1992 election, lost footing as a result of his slow response to Hurricane Andrew. And so Clinton is the first president to recognize that there's political value being seen as someone who really makes sure that when there's a problem, when there's a disaster, the government really steps in and helps take care of it. But FEMA is a Carter creation.
Then from FDR forward through Harry Truman and on, does the presidency continue to be thought of as the place where we're going to have immediate reaction and response to disasters around the country? Or do we fall back into a kind of pre-FDR, more like a Coolidge mode for the presidency?
We never fell back to that pre-mode, but there is this sense of increased government involvement at smaller and smaller and more local disasters. You know, in my book, I try and define what a disaster is. And let's say there's a five-car pileup on 95, which is a corridor that connects the eastern seaboard, north to south. And some people die. That's a tragedy, but it's not necessarily a disaster in the sense that it has ripple effects across the country. But then something like Hurricane Katrina or 9/11, these things have much more scope and scale. And these are the kinds where the federal government gets more involved. And now, once you have FEMA or an agency that is specifically designed to deal with disasters, I mean, it's the Federal Emergency Management Administration, then there's obviously an expectation that anytime there's a disaster, they're going to get involved. So I would say it's more of a process of accretion. The government's role gets bigger and bigger. The expectations get higher and higher. And it's not overnight to go from 1927 with the Mississippi floods to what we have today, but it happens gradually over time.
What are some of the most important moments in that development?
Well, I think one that I like to look at is in 1969, again, we've got hurricanes. Richard Nixon is in power, and he sends Spiro Agnew, the vice president, to the Mississippi region again to deal with it and to assess the situation, see what's going on. And Agnew comes back with a report. So first of all, vice president is more senior than the Secretary of Commerce, as we had in the Coolidge-Hoover situation. But second of all, Spiro Agnew comes back with a report, and he says that one of the problems was that we didn't know at the local level, the people in Mississippi didn't know how severe the hurricane was going to be. And so that hurricane index we hear, a Category 1, Category 2, Category 3 hurricane, that develops out of that incident in 1969 where Nixon asked, what can the bureaucracy do to improve things? So that I would say is generally a positive development. And then also I mentioned Bush in 1992 with Hurricane Andrew, doesn't seem to do a great job. And then there's a sense that, you know, if you want to be reelected president, you've got to be ready for these kinds of things. And then obviously the 2000 with George W. Bush in office, FEMA had a big moment with 9/11. And then there was Katrina, which showed, I think, some of the limitations of FEMA. And FEMA has made some significant reforms to get more modern and better, and they think about things in advance, and they pre-deploy resources in a way that they didn't, and they use social media. So there's been a lot of improvement, but also just a lot more government involvement.
Can you talk a little bit about the way in which those crises have either helped to make or break a presidency? We think of Hurricane Katrina having a very harmful effect on George W. Bush's presidency, Andrew with his father. Others have, though, have been moments where presidents have been able to sort of show that they can rise to the challenge that the nation seems to expect from them.
Yeah, it's a great question. And if you look at my book, you actually have an appendix that I wrote that has the five best and five worst presidents in terms of dealing with disasters. And I put George W. Bush, for whom I worked, full disclosure, on both lists. I put him on the best list for how he responded to 9/11 in that great moment when he stands on the fire truck and he says, "I can't hear you, but soon the rest of the world is going to hear you." And he stands up with the bullhorn. And that was a great moment. It was a unifying moment. And I think he really helped bring the country together in a very traumatic time. But then I also put him on the worst list for his response to Hurricane Katrina, which, again, I was involved in it. So I say it with pain. It was inept. We didn't do a good job. We were slow to respond. We didn't communicate well. FEMA, as I said, needed to make some significant improvements. And Bush was slow to recognize the severity of what was happening and the need for him to get involved. So I think that really hurt his presidency, hurt his legacy, and really, really, and you know, I was somewhat new to my senior role in the Domestic Policy Council at the time. It really hurt his ability to carry out a second term agenda.
Talk a little bit about the, because you had such interesting, amazing firsthand experience. What's it like in a White House when there is this kind of crisis, as there was with Hurricane Katrina?
Frustrating is the number one word. I mean, you're trying to do all these things. You've got all these resources, and you just can't necessarily make it happen. It's not so easy to just snap your fingers and suddenly, you know, 10,000 water bottles show up at the Super Bowl, at the Superdome. So there's so many obstacles. There's so much bureaucracy. People, even at the most senior levels, don't necessarily communicate. Sometimes they haven't even met. I always say that you've got to do these tabletop exercises in advance. You've got to prepare for disaster so that people know who their compatriots are, their colleagues in the other agencies, what their capabilities are, what their limitations are, what their roles are. And I always say that when it comes to a disaster, if you're handing out your business cards to your other federal partners at that moment, then you've already failed because the people don't know each other. They don't know how to work as a team.
What about lessons? I'm thinking of, as you know, of course, a lot of local, county, and state governments have to deal with disasters, not national disasters, but disasters in their area. Has there been any states or counties or localities where you say, boy, there is terrific disaster response there? There's some lessons that we could or should or did learn at the federal level.
Yeah, well, I mean, Florida is a state that has terrific disaster preparedness people. And they have to, right? Because they're a coastal state. They get a lot of hurricanes, other kind of things. Weird things seem to happen in Florida. So Florida tends to be very good. And there were hurricanes last year in Florida. DeSantis was thinking of running for president. I mean, obviously, we now know that he ran and didn't do so well. But at the time, he was thinking about running. And he and Biden, even though they were potential rivals, I think they cooperated quite well on that. I even wrote a piece in the Wall Street Journal talking about how it was in both their interests politically to cooperate, but also in the interests of the people of both the United States and just specifically the people of Florida that they cooperate. And I think they did. So having a team on the ground that knows what they're doing is very useful. But then you contrast that to the Puerto Rico hurricane that took place when Trump was in office. Even Puerto Rico, quite frankly, just does not have the same level of capabilities in disaster response. And I think that was part of the problem why you had some of those issues. Another issue was a logistical issue. And again, I wrote about this in the Wall Street Journal, that Puerto Rico is an island. And you have all these great charitable, generous people in the United States who, when something happens, they want to go there. So they get on 95 or they get on the highways and they drive to the disaster with resources, with flashlights, with food. And you can't have that on an island. So the fact that Puerto Rico was off the coast and not necessarily connected by the roadway, the interstate system that Eisenhower built, makes it harder for us as a nation to respond to some of the things.
Before we continue with our conversation, I'd like to have one of our faculty members tell you about a special documents-based graduate program for teachers of American history, government, and civics.
Hi. This is John Moser, Chair of the Master of Arts in American History and Government program at Ashland University. If you are an educator who teaches U.S. history, government, or politics, our program may be just what you've been looking for. Our approach is to emphasize primary sources, since we think the best way to study the past is to read the words of those who lived it. We have a distinguished faculty made up of professors from both Ashland University and from colleges and universities across the country. And they're not there to lecture to you. We think it's better to learn through conversation about the documents. Ours is a hybrid program with two different types of seminar. The first are our week-long intensive in-person courses during the summers on the beautiful campus of Ashland University. The second are our live synchronous online seminars offered throughout the year. So if you're a social studies teacher and you're looking to deepen your understanding of America's past and its politics, please check out the Master of Arts in American History and Government program. You can do that by visiting tah.org/programs.
What if that raises a question in my mind? I'm thinking about what about non-government actors, Red Cross being probably one of the biggest and most famous of them, but many, many, many others from the faith community to just civic organizations and the rest. What's been their role, especially in contemporary times, in disaster response? And has that made it easier and more effective for the federal government to respond to disasters, or more complicated and more difficult?
I think it makes it easier and better that we are a generous nation. And, you know, Tocqueville wrote about these kind of platoons, local platoons of people who want to help in the civic engagement. And that's a great strength of America in Katrina and in some other disasters. We have what's called the Cajun Navy, which is people who get in their own boat and they go and rescue people who are trapped by flooding. And that's a beautiful thing about America. I would say it doesn't make it more difficult, but sometimes it makes it complex, because one of the things you have to do as a federal official is coordinate what's going on at the state level, what's going on with these local people who are trying to help. And then also all kinds of people are trying to donate stuff. I remember in Katrina, we specifically had to assign a staffer to deal with all the generous offers of contributions from both Americans and also foreign nations who wanted to help. They genuinely wanted to help, but you have to figure out, how are you going to manage those contributions? Which ones are legal for you to accept? What can you do with them? How do you deploy them? So I wouldn't say it makes it more difficult, but it does add to the complexity of the situation.
What about dealing with the press? In these moments, the press, I don't want to say it loves crisis, but it certainly has an appetite for crisis. When a real crisis hits, it dominates the 24/7 news cycle. The difficulty, the challenges of dealing with the press in a crisis situation.
Look, you said you don't want to say the press loves crisis. I'll say it. The press does love crisis, right? It generates headlines. It generates clicks. This is what they live for. Obviously, they don't want the human tragedy, but they want man bites dog. They don't want dog bites man, which is a more regular story. So yes, the press gets involved. They have to be managed. One of the things I teach in classes about disasters and crisis is how to deal with the press. You've got to be very upfront with them. You've got to be honest with them. It doesn't mean you have to tell them absolutely everything. But if you are misleading in any way, then that damages your own credibility. That makes it harder for you as a government official to get the American people to do what you may want or need them to do at a moment of crisis. So you've got to be very careful and ginger in the way you deal with the press, and it requires some thought and expertise and also practice. The reason I talk about these tabletop exercises, it's not just so I know how to call FEMA and get them to move material from one place to another, but also how do the people who are responsible for dealing with the press, how do they talk to the press? It's actually no coincidence, if you ask me, that in 2009, when you had the flu, the swine flu that I mentioned earlier in the Obama administration, most of the government did pretty well because it was early in the Obama administration. Most of the people who were handling things were career officials. The person who had the biggest mess up at the time, I don't know if you recall this, was actually the vice president at the time, was Joe Biden, who said that thing, unguarded moment, on one of the morning shows about how, well, I wouldn't get on a train or a plane at this time, which kind of induced panic. And he was new to the executive branch. He'd been a senator for many years, but he hadn't had the training and the practice and the tabletop exercises that people get once they're in government for a while. And so he spoke, unguardedly, which he still does, as we know now that he's our president. And that was kind of the biggest mess up of that one particular response.
And those are a Katrina, even a terrible event like 9/11. Those are disasters that hit unexpectedly. But the disaster comes and then the disaster goes. There's the aftermath of disaster that has to be dealt with, but there's a discrete time, certainly for an event like Katrina, there's a discrete time in which the disaster happens. In contrast, you have a disaster, an unexpected crisis like COVID, where a president doesn't know exactly where it came from, how it's spreading, how long it will be a significant crisis for the United States. You talk about the differences between previous disasters and the COVID situation.
Yeah, well, first of all, there's some similarities. Even with Katrina, for example, you had the initial response. And when I was at the White House, we had the Homeland Security Council and Department of Homeland Security were in charge. And then it became a question of getting resources to the right places and what programs were people who were displaced eligible for. And then it went into the realm of the Domestic Policy Council, where I worked at the time. You know, what HUD grants can you get? What job training is there available from the Department of Labor? How are you going to get kids who are displaced from their schools the education they need? That's the Department of Education. And then it becomes an issue of rebuilding and economic development, and that moved to the National Economic Council. So there's a constant shift in who's really in charge of the crisis based on what the needs were at the time. So you see this also to some degree with COVID, but I think the problem with COVID, given the way you described it well, I think, Jeff, that you don't really know when it ends, that I think we were in crisis mode on COVID longer than we needed to be, and you still had people out of school after the vaccine was available, for example, and after we knew that the disease didn't really spread outside, and after we knew that masks weren't so effective, and after we knew that kids don't necessarily pick up the disease or spread it to the extent that initially feared. So I think the federal government was kind of slow to take us out of crisis mode, but I also understand and have some sympathy because the American people were scared, and it was this strange new disease, and it was affecting certain people in surprising and unexpected ways. So it's not easy to know when it's over, but I don't think we did a good job of getting to the end of that one.
Yeah, can you say a little bit more about that? Is that surprising to you that the federal government, as you say, was sort of in crisis mode perhaps too long? You've studied these things. Would you expect that kind of continued crisis mentality, especially when we don't know? Or would you have expected the federal government to back off more sooner rather than later in terms of the crisis mentality?
Well, I think some of it was affected by the politics of the situation. There was this sense that the Trump administration maybe wasn't doing enough, and Biden came in saying he was going to do more. And he kind of had this vision of doing more and keeping the crisis going longer, making sure that people were masked longer, you know, pushing the vaccines. And so I think the contrast and the shift in administrations contributed to it. But I think another really bad actor here was the teachers union. And I think the fact that the teachers union gives money and resources and backs almost exclusively the Democratic Party, and what the teachers union wanted was to keep their teachers out of school as long as possible, I think that led to some disastrous, and I use the word advisedly, disastrous impact on America's school children. But the Democrats, because they get so much support from the teachers union, were loath to push back against them because it had a political cost to them. So I think that exacerbated a fraught situation.
When you look at the span of presidential crisis from COVID in contemporary times all the way back to the early Republic, you've talked about one lesson at least, which is preparation, preparation, preparation. Be ready because it's actually going to happen. Don't think you're going to escape it. As you said, many presidents come in with a very ambitious agenda and find themselves mostly being, as you put it nicely, crisis managers. What are some other important lessons that you've gleaned from your study?
Yeah, you've got to know when to get involved and when not to get involved. I mean, anyway, I was giving the contrast between, let's say, the 95 pileup and something like Katrina. You know, some things that government can help with the situation, somewhere it's really not government's role. So I think that's important. Communication, how you communicate to the public, I think is extremely important. And also, you know, I think you have to be willing to fire people. I think Bush made a mistake in not firing Brown, the head of FEMA earlier, Mike Brown. And remember, he said, Brownie, you're doing a heck of a job, which I get it. You're trying to support your people and you don't want to throw them under the bus. But at the same time, he wasn't equipped for the job and he wasn't doing a great job with it. And I think you see this contrast between the Trump administration and the Biden administration. I think Trump was too quick to fire people and fired too many people. And I think Biden is too slow to fire people. I think there are some people who would we would benefit from them being fired. This isn't even necessarily in the disaster area, but you think about Lloyd Austin and his going MIA, is disappearing for a while without telling anybody. You can't do that as Secretary of Defense. And then you think about all these so-called anonymous aides who are objecting to Biden's policy of supporting Israel. Well, you can't work in the White House and object to the president's policy. If you work in the White House and you object to the president's policy, you have two choices. Number one is you carry out the president wants because he's the elected one, or you resign with honor. And we've had people who've done this over time. And there are a couple of officials in the Clinton administration, including a guy named Peter Adelman, who resigned because he didn't like the welfare reform. Now, I disagree with him politically because I thought the welfare reform bill of 96 was a good and necessary reform. But I agree with him from a administrative and management standpoint that if he couldn't abide what the government was doing, he was right to resign. And today you have these people, including White House interns, who think that they can object to the president's policy. And I think that's it's a little far afield from disasters, but I think that's unconscionable and not the way it should work. So if you're president, you've got to be ready to fire people who are not doing what they're supposed to be doing.
What about presidential character? What do these moments of crisis reveal and show about the most important character traits that a president needs?
Oh, absolutely. I think empathy is important. Bill Clinton was one of the best at this. You know, I feel your pain. George H.W. Bush, it looked like he was disconnected during Hurricane Andrew. And I think that hurt him, gave a sense that he liked dealing with the foreign policy issues, but not the needs of the everyday Americans. Leadership. Can you take charge of a difficult situation where you've got all these disparate elements trying to get whatever they want done and not necessarily working in concert? Communications. How do you communicate to the American people in a way that doesn't terrify them, but also galvanizes them to do what needs to be done? So I think many of the characteristics of leadership emerge during disaster. In fact, I do my own leadership training for companies and large organizations about how you can learn lessons from the president on management and leadership of your own organization based on what the presidents have done. And I have a specific module just on how to deal with disasters, because it's going to come in every organization. You don't know when it's going to come, but it's going to come on your tenure.
What about the organization of the executive branch itself? Are some presidents, I'm assuming this is true, some presidents are better organizers and managers and runners of the executive branch to the extent it's within their power, and some are worse, and that may show itself in a crisis?
Yeah, absolutely. Look, you need to know what the levers of power are, where the levers of power are, how to do it. Some of it comes from time. I mean, I'd much rather have a president who has to deal with a crisis in the third year of his presidency than the first 6 months, because you're still learning how things work. But some of it also is natural ability. Can you galvanize people to follow you? Do you have a theory of government? Do you know how the various branches work together? Or what are the things that you can bring out so you can bring out the best in people? Can you inspire people? So I think how you run the government is absolutely very important in how you respond to a crisis.
And does that include consultation with Congress? Because, of course, we're thinking about disaster response as an executive action, and obviously there is statutory basis for the president to act in emergencies. But what about relationships with Congress? How important are they? Or in those moments, do presidents ignore Congress and just focus on what needs to be done immediately?
No, you can't ignore Congress. They're extremely important. And they're important in a couple of ways. First of all, is funding for these disasters. I mean, so much of the needs are met by government resources, federal resources, and Congress controls the power of the purse. And so I think that's extremely important to have good relations with your appropriators and your funders. The second is if Congress is denouncing you for how you're handling it or mishandling a crisis, that's already, that's kind of a huge vulnerability, and that can undercut your ability to be successful. So keeping Congress informed. And I think Congress, you know, I know we're in a hyper-political era, but I think Congress and most people are inclined to want to be with the president or help the president or support the president in times of national crisis. And so if you can keep them on board, I think that's really strong. And then the third is in terms of after assessment. And this includes both how can we improve FEMA or whatever agency after a disaster so it does better in the future, but also how can you rebuild the affected area? Like how do you rebuild New Orleans after Katrina? So I think all of those are important aspects of maintaining good relations with Congress when a disaster strikes.
And is there a particular president that you think of in your study who had yeah, this person really understood how to work with Congress during a crisis.
I know best the Bush administration because I was there. And I think Bush did some things well in terms of working with Congress to get appropriations and funding after his crisis. But, you know, there were a lot of congressmen also and senators undercutting him during the crisis. So maybe he could have stayed in better touch with some of the members afterwards. So, you know, it's a mixed bag. And obviously, it's always a partisan calculation goes into how you deal with Congress as well.
Yeah. What's the most, if this is a fair question, what's the most surprising thing that you learned by studying presidential response to crisis?
So I think the number one lesson that I learned was that it wasn't always this way. And I talked about this earlier, but that in the 19th century, there was little expectation nor constitutional mechanism for the government getting involved in crisis. And it's really a 20th century development that now you see the federal government and specifically the president being the disaster manager in chief. And that wasn't always the case.
Are there suggested reforms looking forward where this country is right now, particularly the federal government in disaster response? Do you have any particular reforms that you would say, boy, if we could do these one, two, or three things, that would really improve our prospects for disaster management in the future?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I do talk about this specifically in Shall We Wake the President, but this sense that we've got to get a handle on what the government gets involved in and doesn't, right? There are some things like responding to a bioterror attack. I want the federal government on that because Utah doesn't really have its own bioterror response capability. But at the same time, doesn't the federal government have to get involved in every flood or hurricane? Because those are predictable and also localized. I mean, Florida is going to face hurricanes and floods, and that's just part of what it is to live in Florida. And Florida, as I said, has a very good disaster response team. So I would like to see the federal government focus more effort on dealing with fewer types of disasters, and I think that would be helpful. But, you know, members of Congress being what they are, I don't expect that, and the media drumming up expectations also limits the ability to make that reform. So I think it would be a challenge for a president to take that on, but I think it's worthy of exploration.
You said earlier you have a top five and a bottom five list of presidents. I think our readers will have, maybe they have to get the book to explore the whole list, but who's your number one on both?
Well, I think Franklin Roosevelt did a great job with responding to the Depression. And I don't mean that I agree with his economic policies, because I disagree with many of them, but the way he communicated with the American people about it, I think was very effective, and he really showed that he was in charge. And so people look to someone who dealt with a disaster and they say, oh boy, Roosevelt. So again, this is despite my disagreement with his actual economic policies. And then the worst, I mean, there's so many, but Herbert Hoover and the Great Depression. I mean, it's kind of flip side of the coin with Roosevelt. I mean, Hoover was still talking up the economy and saying we're, you know, over the worst of it, well after the nation was in the deepest throes of the Depression, and people just weren't buying it. So you've got to communicate effectively so that people know that you are, you know, even if you're trying to make things look better, you're also telling the truth. And Hoover was seen as kind of trying to put icing on a cake that wasn't really there.
Well, incredibly important insights, because as you know, as our listeners know, the country will face unexpected crises. An incredibly important book that I want to recommend to all of our listeners, and of course to policymakers and to anyone who's going to be involved when disaster happens, Shall We Wake the President? Two Centuries of Disaster Management from the Oval Office. Tevi Troy, thanks so much for taking the time to join us on The American Idea.
Thanks so much, and I really appreciate it, and I appreciate your good questions.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The American Idea. If you enjoyed this episode, remember to subscribe at Apple Podcast, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and leave a 5-star review. If you want to learn more or get involved in Ashbrook's vital work, visit our website, ashbrook.org.